Professor of Theoretical Physics at the Radboud University of Nijmegen and best known as being one of the founder of the Causal Dynamical Triangulations Program. And Renate will be taking questions after her talk, so please post your questions in the chat or save them and ask them with a raised hand after the talk. So Renate, whenever you're ready, please feel free to go ahead. And currently we don't see your PDF yet. Now we do see it.
Right? Now we do see it, it's also full screen.
Yes.
Okay, when being introduced as the speaker doesn't need an introduction, I feel a little like a fossil, but maybe I am, you know. So let me start by very much thanking the organizers for bringing us together, well, in virtual space and real time. So my talk will be about a case of remarkable roundness in quantum gravity. And let me jump straight in. So the context of my talk is a search for quantum gravity as a non-perturbative theory, diffeomorphism invariant quantum field theory in four space-time dimensions with a positive cosmological constant. My key take-home messages today will be three. Number one, well, it's taken us quite a while, but we have now finally understood how to put gravity on a lattice correctly, which means primarily without destroying diffeomorphism invariants. Then my second point is also of a rather general nature, that I believe that progress in quantum gravity will be achieved by studying observables. And I can report there's a new kid on the block called quantum Ricci curvature. Putting together one and two, so there is a new result, namely that the geometry of the emergent quantum universe in the approach to quantum gravity I've been studying is near the Planck scale compatible with that of a constantly curved de Sitter space. So, and if you want to read about this new and truly quite remarkable result, you can read, go and look at this recent preprint that I've written together with my PhD student, Milos Klipkor, who's about to finish. How do I now advance? Now, in view of the really exciting data that's coming out of and are still expected from astrophysical observations and gravitational waves in particular, we as theorists are challenged to complete our quantum gravity theories to make reliable predictions while minimizing free parameters and ad hoc assumptions. The particular route I'm taking is to tackle quantum gravity and geometric degrees of freedom directly in a non-perturbative Planckian regime. So to speak, you know, jump right in at the deep end without any appeal to boundary dualities, dictionary. That's a different paradigm. So let me remind you of the beauties of classical GR as we've learned them in from our textbooks. So it's, of course, a theory of space-time and not on space-time. And that's, in the classical theory, captured by its curvature properties. So given the central role curvature plays classically, let me rephrase the quest for quantum gravity in a maybe slightly unusual way in which it's usually not posed. Namely, is there a way to think about non-perturbative quantum gravity as a theory of quantum curvature? And what would that be, that quantum curvature? So far, this is a proposition that has remained largely unexplored and for some good reasons, as we'll see later. But what we've been able to do is to set up a new line of research that does define a meaningful notion of quantum Ricci curvature in quantum gravity and leads to some quite intriguing results. My setting is quite conservative, so it is that of traditional quantum field theory, but with a geometric twist, you could say. So what I'm inspired by, or what this whole research has been inspired by ultimately, is the extremely successful example of QCD, whose non-perturbative properties we are exploring in a quite, you know, amazing way nowadays, from a technical point of view, in terms of lattice gauge field theory. So the question is, why can we not also explore quantum gravity via a lattice approach? Now, what really was the breakthrough in the case of gauge field theory is really that idea of Wilson's, whom I'm citing here, this 1974 paper, who really brought us the lattice, but with an exact realization of gauge invariance. So the way I'm going to argue is there is an analog of that for gravity, and it uses an age-old idea, back to Redshift from 1961, where you encode curved geometry into piecewise flat geometry. So, and that plays, I will argue, the analogous role also with respect to diffeomorphism invariants that that Wilson's idea play in lattice gauge field theory. So the most modern implementation, okay, of course I'm slightly partial and biased, is that of causal dynamic triangulations, or CDT, which is a non-perturbative, background independent, and manifestly diffeomorphism invariant approach, so based on the path integral, so very much like lattice QCD, but it's regularized not on fixed hypercubic lattices, but on dynamical lattices. And just to avoid misunderstanding, so we are putting things on the lattice, but we are really applying the standard idea of thinking of that as a regulator, and of course, in the end, having to remove the short distance cutoff, so sending the lattice spacing to zero and looking for meaningful scaling limits. So there is no fundamental discreteness involved here. And also the idea is, of course, that your results, hopefully, in the end will be of a universal nature. So they should be largely independent of the discrete choices you made when setting up this regularization. So these ideas are not new. But the nature of gravity makes them much more challenging to realize on a lattice compared to non-abelian gauge field theory. So in the starting in the 80s, in the 1980s, or more precisely in 1979, people very actively and inspired by the success of QCD studied gravity on the lattice. So that involved starting from formulations of gravity that look as much as possible as gauge theories, and these are the so-called first order formulations of general relativity, where you use a Fierbein, little e here, and a spin connection, omega, and simply put it on the lattice. The first of those, I should say, was Lee Smolin, who's of course with us in the conference, who was really a pioneer in doing this. But there were many others, some of whom I mentioned here on this slide, Daskaku Townsend, you've seen from the 70s, Manion Taylor, Kaku, Tomboulis, and these were suggestions on how one should put things on the lattice, but then there were brave people who actually did the calculation and did put things on the lattice. And perform numerical simulations. So there's these Italian groups, Caraccio and Felizetto, Casella da Damanea, but there were others also. Unfortunately, this program really wasn't successful in the sense that the Monte Carlo simulations were run, they never found interesting phase structure in the sense of higher order phase transition, which would have been natural candidates to define continuum theories. But of course, there are various issues and problems associated with defining these models, and so known problems. So one is the question of the measure, the gauge group, so the analog of the local gauge translation, which are the frame rotations, are of course non-compact if you do Lorentzian things. If you go look Euclidean, well, then they are compactified. But then the question is, well, is that still gravity? And you still have, of course, the Fierbein directions, which lead to divergences. You have the question of reflection positivity, which some of these, but certainly not all of these models, one could show. And then you have metricity condition, which turned out to be a really technical stumbling block. That is the fact that E and omega are not independent, but of course you can express omega as a function of E. So, but how to tell the lattice theory that, there was another question. On top of that, there were maybe larger elephants, even larger than those problems in the room. So one of them is, well, what happened to diffeomorphism invariants? Of course, you see the local, the frame rotations, they are accounted for in the same way as there are in Wilsonian lattice gauge theory. However, the diffeomorphism invariants, well, is nowhere implemented. So you're just putting your fields on the lattice. Of course, they had an X dependence before you did that. Now they live on a lattice, but the diffeomorphisms don't act anymore. So people usually would say, oh, well, we don't know. Diffeomorphism invariance is clearly very badly broken. But the result of that is, of course, it's very difficult to understand what's physics and what's gauge. And it's even difficult to address that question. And then, of course, unlike the Young-Mills action, one has to remember that the Einstein action is unbounded below. And this is, of course, a potential killer of any four-dimensional Euclidean gravitational path integral. So that's the famous conformal mode problem. So I would just also remind people who are fascinated by, you know, the magic of the Euclidean gravitational path integral. Well, in 2D, it's fine. But in higher D, of course, in 4D, really that path integral doesn't exist in any, you know, even for physicists, meaningful sense of the word. So there is some trouble here. Now let me come to the crucial point regarding how kind of diffeomorphisms can nevertheless be incorporated and thought about in a lattice context. So really, the idea goes back to Reggie, as I have already mentioned. So the strategy is, and it comes purely from the classical theory, to approximate curved spacetimes by simplicial manifolds. So a simplicial manifold is a triangulated manifold. And I would really say, so this paper that came out in 1961 called General Relativity Without Coordinates, it really to some extent, especially in its meaning for the quantum theory, is a profound but so far somewhat underappreciated idea. Now, what is the essence of the approach? Well, you use building blocks, so like the one I presented here in four dimensions, they are triangular, so a generalization is a four-dimensional generalization of a tetrahedron, you could say, and it's flat on the inside. Now, by gluing these objects together, by identifying the three-dimensional boundaries pairwise in such a way that a simplicial manifold results, gives rise to approximations of curved manifolds, and that works for any dimension and any signature. Now, the crucial thing to realize is when you specify the edge lengths of all the edges and demand that the interior is flat, these data uniquely fix the geometry on the inside. And if you then give me the gluing data, namely a list of how these building blocks are glued together pairwise, I know everything about the geometry. And no coordinates are needed in doing this, in describing the geometry. Now, the way these geometries contain curvature is depicted here in this little sketch at the bottom. So imagine you have just five Euclidean equilateral triangles, and you glue them together around a central vertex. Then, of course, you know you're talking about a piece of non-flat space because there is a so-called deficit angle. If you cut up these triangle instead of triangles as indicated, you would find there is a 60 degree angle missing. And that's, of course, a direct measure of the Gaussian curvature, kind of what's missing to 2 pi. And that's an indication of intrinsic curvature. And in this way, this idea, the analog of this idea, works in higher dimensions also and gives rise to these simplicial manifolds where the curvature is located or concentrated in a delta function-like manner at d minus two-dimensional subsimplices. So in two dimensions as the vertices, but in four dimensions this would be concentrated on two-dimensional triangles. Now, the full power of the idea in the context of the gravitational path integral is really not to use kind of quantum ratchet calculus where you leave the edge length variable, but to make the edge lengths all the same. Allowing yourself, for the Lorentzian case, time-like and space-like lengths, but which are essentially identical to what you think of as a UV cutoff. Yeah. So, and in this way, when you then write down the path integral will be a sum over all possible gluings of these triangle subjects to some triangular building block subjects to some gluing rules. And there are no coordinates anywhere, so diffeomorphisms don't act. But of course, you need to refer, often when you do calculations, you need to refer to the building blocks and to the vertices, and you label them. But you set up the Monte Carlo simulation in such a way that the whole setup is relabeling invariant. So truly, there are no degrees of freedom associated to labeling or coordinates in this anymore. Now let me come to the central topic number two of my talk, which are observables. So regardless of the microscopic degrees of freedom and the dynamical principle governing quantum gravity at the Planck scale in your favorite approach, you need observables. First, you need them to understand the gauge invariant. In this sense here, I mean coordinate, but if you're invariant content of your theory, but you also need them to compare to other models. And that is even true before you develop any phenomenology in the sense of connecting quantum gravity to nature. That's something we'd love to do, but we are not there yet. And of course, lastly, you need them to establish the existence of a classical limit that is consistent with general relativity, which is one of the kind of conditions we impose on our theories. Now, let me remind you that classically, gravitational observables, of course, have to be diffeomorphism invariant, but because of the nature of that invariance and the way the diffeomorphisms act, namely not locally at a point as they do in Young-Mills, these gravitational observables tend to be non-local. So, for example, here I've written down just the Lorentzian form matrix G mean u of x and say the Ricci scalar R of x. These are not observables. Well, clearly G mean u still has non-trivial frame indices that are being rotated, so that's obvious. But also both of these depend on a space-time point x. But of course, in a theory of pure gravity, there is no invariant way of marking a given space-time point x. So these are not in themselves observable. But for example, the four-dimensional integral over the space-time m of the scalar curvature with the correct measure is, of course, an observable. So, but this is, of course, very non-local. Now, when you come to the quantum theory, the question is, how are these structures reflected there? Now, non-perturbative quantum gravity, that's going to be genuinely Planckian, and whatever comes out as some kind of ground state of our quantum gravity theories, let me call it quantum space-time, for want of a better word, are unlikely to be described by the classical smooth metric fields G mean u of x. But this is how I phrase it here, there better ought to be notions in your theory of at least distance and volume. And these can be then used to construct pre-geometric quantum observables with suitable invariance properties that mimic what happens in the classical theory. Okay, well, implementation is another matter. Yeah. So the long-standing problem of non-perturbative quantum gravity is really that we had no idea what observables to calculate and how to calculate them. So I've written here down here, so OHAD is my observable. So we are looking at some formal vacuum excitation value. On the right-hand side, I have a Euclideanized integral. That is the partition function. I've just inserted in the trace, and here's the Einstein-Hilbert action. So the question is, yeah, can I make sense of that? What are the O's? And do I have the techniques to compute those? So I want now to point out that it's no longer true that we have no longer an idea to how to calculate things, thanks to significant body of results and to some significant extent, they come from this research branch of dynamical triangulations, or DT, which people have looked at since the mid-1980s. So here, what one does is one assembles curved manifolds from identical flat building blocks, as I described it in my slide where I set up Regis ideas, and then one investigates ensembles, statistical ensembles of these objects and their behavior in suitable continuum limits. So analytically, one can do this in 2D, and this actually started with investigations of bosonic string theory, or in search of a non-perturbative theory of formulation of a bosonic string theory. So there were works by Davi, Amjan Duhus Fröhlich, Kazakov, I mean, a whole very, very active branch that still continues as under the heading of non-critical string theory, and is also very richly connected to theories of conformal field theory in 2D. But very importantly for quantum gravity, one can implement this, although not analytically, but numerically, in 4D, as a way to try and understand what quantum gravity is. So, and here's a relevant people. I mean, this people started doing this in 1992, Amistein Migdal and Amjan and Jokiewicz. And this amounted very importantly to a non-perturbative and manifestly coordinate independent way of implementing the Euclidean gravitational path integral. This dynamical triangulations really was a big technical step ahead in trying to do these computations and set up the path integral and making things computable. So if you like, going back to the lattice framework, it's really a very concrete lattice formulation that allows you to define and importantly quantitatively evaluate certain pre-geometric observables. And very extensively studied have been the spectral and Hausdorff dimension. So when I call these pre-geometric, because of course spaces have dimensions before you even start talking about their geometry. But importantly, these are notions that continue to be well-defined in a regime very far from classicality or semi-classicality. And the construction also addressed several very important issues and made progress on these other gauge theoretic formulations of gravity on the lattice that I mentioned earlier. So there is a well-defined measure. This is a uniform measure, so kind of a democratic measure. The unboundedness problem related to the conformal factor is kind of non-perturbatively resolved. Uniqueness is really in the sense of having very few free parameters around that can be tuned, kind of if things go wrong, is also realized. About coordinate invariants, I have already talked. And it turns out these models all have a bare cosmological constant that's positive, but also a renormalized cosmological constant that's positive. Kind of comes out as part of the construction. So here in this yellow box, I'm writing down on the left the formal gravitational, I mean pure gravity path integral, where you are integrating over all geometries, so Riemannian metrics, modular diffeomorphism. So we are Euclidean, doing Euclidean gravity. These are all Euclidean quantum gravity models. G Newton and lambda appear, of course, here as part of the Einstein-Hilbert action. And in DT, this is turned into a sum over inequivalent triangulations T, with some simple, somewhat uninteresting measure factor. And here you weigh each of them by the Regge analog of the Einstein-Hilbert action that depends on T. But then you still have to do work. You still have to take a continuum and scaling limit. Now, these models are very interesting, but they seem to have some deficiencies. And it turns out, or it seems as if you want to find extended four-dimensional space-time in a suitable large-scale limit coming out of these models and realize reflection positivity, which is, of course, kind of a pre-stage of the final theory being unitary, and find second-order phase transitions, it seems the Euclidean models are not quite good enough. But when one goes Lorentzian with a suitable, accompanied by the existence of a suitable Wick rotation, one ends up at this formulation that my colleagues and I kind of co-founded and have developed, namely the causal dynamical triangulation. So it's a causal version. And if I point you now to the same kind of the central object is now the Lorentzian path integral. So you have factors of I here. You're talking about Lorentzian geometries. And these can be then represented here on the right-hand side by the requisite discrete ingredients of the CDT setup, with the little addition compared with previously that you're now summing over inequivalent causal triangulations. And the causal means each one of them has a well-defined causal or light constructor. And in particular, what you don't allow are topology changes of space as a function of time. Okay, let me go back to my theme of quantum observables. So now you have a setup, and I'm not going to say very much about CDT, but for the purposes of this talk, basically treat it as a black box and just a tool that enables me to address issues regarding observables. So whatever statements have come out of these formulations, so on the phase structure, on the phase structure, the critical behavior of the theory, so the existence of phase transitions, behavior along renormalization group trajectories, and most importantly, properties of a quantum spacetime that kind of gets generated in this model, they have come from evaluating a few non-perturbative quantum observables. And these operationally are defined in terms of distance and volume measurements. So that's something, of course, I have already mentioned before. Now, these observables, the outcomes, display a significant degree of universality and robustness. So we evaluate, of course, these observables in what is called finite size scaling. So we are only looking for properties that survive a continuum and scaling limit. In particular, so they are very, very valuable. Although we have only few, they can, for example, and do very often signal pathologies that exist in these models. So it's non-perturbative pathologies that very generically, these ensembles of very dynamical, very quantum fluctuating geometries display. And for all of those in the know, well, it's you know, it's also known as those damped branch polymers. So what is this about? Well, there is a very important observable that was first studied in CDT in four dimensions in a paper from 2005 with my colleagues Ambion and Jokiewicz, where we measured the spectral dimension on four-dimensional geometry, so in full quantum gravity in the CDT approach. And what we found is this very interesting dynamical dimensional reduction. So we saw that on large scales, the spectral dimension is 4, as one would expect classically, but on smaller scales, when approaching the Planck scale, it's actually compatible with a much smaller number, and namely 2, if you want to choose an integer. So this spectral dimension is pre-geometric, but nevertheless can be makes a difference between calling a model promising and calling a model clearly insufficient, because what comes out of it doesn't have spectral dimension 4 on any scale, but for instance, spectral dimension 4/3, and these are the damn branch polymers. So although sometimes you think you're looking at a model of geometry and extended quantum geometry, in reality, you're just rehashing systems of branch polymers. And that can, of course, be a great disappointment, but it's very, very good because you have a way of discriminating between different models before you even start talking about phenomenology. So these ideas, very interestingly, the spectral dimension is relatively straightforward to calculate. And since we are so starved for things that one is able to calculate in quantum gravity, it was picked up by literally, you know, hundreds of people who all reproduced in their various formalisms this phenomenon of dynamical dimensional reduction. And it has been conjectured, and Steve Karlick, who's also here, has made this point very forcefully, that it may actually be a universal feature of quantum gravity. So here is a very beautiful example of a quantum observable, really hopefully enabling us to make progress in our formulation of quantum gravity. Now, going beyond dimension, we have measured something else. We have measured many things, but one thing that is relevant for the last few minutes of my talk is the so-called the global shape of the quantum universe in quantum gravity as we generate it in CVT quantum gravity. And that comes as the function V3, so the three-dimensional volume, as a function of proper time. And the beautiful thing is, and I've mentioned this in many other talks, that this matches the expectation value of that quantity matches that of a classical four-dimensional Euclidean, because we Wickretated the Sitter universe. So here is just, look at, this is the curve, and this is the fit to the cosine cubed curve as a function of proper time. And these red things, they are sizes of typical quantum fluctuations, but they're not error bars. So this is another observable that's not a dimension, so it's geometric. But of course, it's still a far cry from describing local geometry.
Yeah. And after you have about 5 minutes.
Yes, thank you. So the question is, I have now shown, or we have shown, that we have a quantum universe that is the Sitter shaped. But what does that mean? And in particular, does it mean we are looking at some approximation of the Sitter space already, which in Euclidean signature is, of course, around S4? And the answer is no, not at all. So we are just picking out, of course, a single mode of the metric, namely the global scale factor, which is, of course, the same as the Friedman factor. But of course, we are not doing cosmology. So we have all the other degrees of the freedom, degrees of freedom also magic in there. And the question is, how do those behave? So it's not at all clear that what we're looking at is in some approximation in Euclidean the Sitter space in its local geometric properties. So the question is also, well, is that likely? You know, the way we've set up these universes, you know, was in a rather anisotropic way. Well, that was the whole point, give them a causal structure. And disallowing spatial topology changes means that at the level of the discrete building blocks, the gluing rules in the time-like directions look rather different from the gluing rules in the space-like direction. So why should an isotropic S4 come out? Now, how would we possibly make progress in this question? Can we ask, well, what's the distinguishing feature of a classical Sitter space? Well, it's a constant curvature space, right? One of the few we have. And it's this space, a simple space, for positive cosmological constant. So can we say anything about the curvature of this space? And until recently, we couldn't. And of course, it's a generic question for people that like to play around with kind of quantum bit models or some discretized, be it fundamental or otherwise, models of quantum gravity. Yeah, can we define a curvature? Right? In the classical theory, well, we are talking about smooth geometries. We take a couple of derivatives and out pops, well, the Riemann curvature tensor if we do it right. But if you look at something like a simplicial manifold, a typical configuration of the path integral, or even more generic things, you know, like graphs or, you know, can we define a notion of curvature? So it turns out pure mathematicians were there before us and they have pointed us the right way. And the answer is there are meaningful notions of curvature that associate curvature and Ricci curvature in particular to the type of pictures of stuff you see here. So we have implemented this in quantum gravity, a variant that is appropriate for our purposes. So what's the key idea of quantum Ricci curvature? Well, in D-dimensions, the key idea is that one takes two small spheres of radius epsilon. So we are in Riemannian signature, and these live in general on a curved space. So let me use just for illustration a smooth explanation, smooth setting. So their centers are chosen to be a distance delta apart. And what you're now asked is to work out what the distance is between those two circles, the S1s in this case, you are in two dimensions, with these centers. So you have to define what you mean by their distance. There are many ways of doing that. But the essential idea is, if you sit on a space that has positive Ricci curvature, then these two spheres will be closer together than their respective centers. And conversely, if you're sitting on a space of negative Ricci curvature, if you're sitting on flat space, then essentially, you know, each point on one of the spheres has a partner that is exactly delta away on the other sphere. So that's an indication. So then the spheres have the same distance as their centers. So that's a beautiful idea. It's an old idea. It's been picked up in pure math by Jan Olivet, a French mathematician, and we've used it to define a notion of quantum Ricci curvature on our simplicial triangulation, but it's very widely applicable. So what we're using here for the average sphere distance is a simple double integral over all pairs of points. There are many other ways of doing it, but I don't have time to explain this to you. So what happens? So we make a specific choice where the two spheres have center distance delta, but also we choose the radius to be of that same delta length. So we have just a single scale delta in our computations. We do the computation of the two spheres and we divide it by delta. And what comes out is some constant that doesn't interest us. There's a constant term. And then there's a correction term, and this is what we call the curvature. Yeah? So the delta, as I said, is the distance between the centers. And this is something you can implement and then read off what the curvature is at a given scale delta. You can do that on a smooth Riemannian manifold. And what you find is, for instance, if you do the computation in Riemann normal coordinates, is what I have written here. Yeah? So this is the computation in 2, 3, and 4 dimensions for sufficiently small spheres, and this is what you get. A constant, depending on the dimension, plus a delta squared term, and importantly, what appears here is exactly the Ricci curvature. And you see, so it's the Ricci curvature, it's Rij, the Ricci tensor, contracted with 2 times the same vector V. Yeah, so that contains, of course, all information about the Ricci, the Ricci tensor, if you like. So the minus sign enters here. And yeah, so this is what this is in the continuum. But the beauty of the thing is this prescription works in very, very general spaces, including graphs. And it involves, it's so robust and universal because it only involves distance and volume measurements. And of course, we don't know how to talk about tensors of vectors on a non-smooth space. But here you see the double sphere kind of plays the role of a vector. And I have a scale that's delta. And yeah, so that allows me to say something about the curvature of delta. So here is my last slide. What can I now say implementing this on our ensemble of De Sitter-shaped universes? Now, I need something to compare my results to, and we have been constructing over the last 2-3 years a library, a reference library, where we do the computation for various classical spaces so that we recognize from our quantum measurements when we see something that reminds us of a classical behavior. And the most important thing is here, this picture on the left. So this is this quotient d bar sphere distance divided by delta. And you see evaluated on 3 constantly curved spaces in the continuum, hyperbolic space, flat space, and sphere. And you see 3 totally different curves. So what we do, that is a much, much longer story than I'm having time for to describe to you now. We measure this quantity in the sense of averages and ensemble averages and averages over location of these double spheres in 4-dimensional quantum gravity given in CDT with topology S3 cross S1, compactified time, at very large volumes of more than 1 million building blocks. And what we find in a nutshell is that number one, it's clearly positively curved. And this is on distances on the order of 10 Planck's lengths. And the corresponding graph is here on the left. So you see a curve. We know the dots are the measurements. And we know these are characteristic lattice artifacts for small deltas. So we ignore those. The remainder, we approximate by a piece of a curve that is actually the beginning of such a sphere curve. And you see, well, it's a good match. I could say much more about it, but it's very clearly positive. And also the sphere fitting is decent for what we would expect. So here, what we learn is we have a round De Sitter universe. Hooray. But there's even one more very interesting and last thing I want to convey. We can check what the Ricci curvature is. It's a dimensional, it's a directional quantity in the time-like directions and in the space-like directions. So we've done this separately, and we look what we get. And these are the two, the blue dots and the yellow dots here, in the time-like and the space-like direction. So actually, the vertical offset is not at all physical and important, but what's important is the shape. So that the first follows from what I said earlier. It's just the incline of these curves. And when we remove the offset and just look at the data beyond delta equal to 5, these match beautifully. So it's a beautiful further verification that isotropy is regained now at the level of local curvature. So to summarize, non-perturbative quantum gravity can be studied in a lattice setting in close analogy with lattice QCD, taking into account the dynamical nature of geometry. And quantum observables are crucial in investigating those. The full power of Regge's idea of describing geometry without coordinates really unfolds to full power in non-perturbative quantum gravity in terms of these equilateral triangulations, causal or otherwise, and yields a truly geometric path integral without redundancies. Lastly, despite the absence of smoothness, we have managed to define a notion of curvature, this quantum Ricci curvature, which appears to be well defined all the way to the Planck scale. And remarkably, we found good evidence that the emergent quantum De Sitter universe on scales very close to the Planck scale is actually compatible with that of around four sphere, around De Sitter space. So thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you. I will again clap for everybody. So we do have a few minutes for questions, and I think everybody should now be able to unmute themselves. So Robert, if you would like to unmute yourself to ask your question that you posted in the chat during the talk.
Yes. So my question concerns the infrared instability of De Sitter, which is in various approaches. Usually you have to include matter to see that. So how do you see that in CDT?
I cannot ask the question because I'm in a regime where, you know, the computations you do that are related to this instability, they are not accessible to me. Yeah. I mean, you see, I'm still in a very deep quantum regime and I cannot start talking, say, about propagators on the space. So this is still, it's still deep quantum and there is no observable, I think, or I have currently at my disposal to that would answer even potentially your question.
No observables you can define, at least if you include matter. Because then you can, for example, measure local expansion rate.
Well, Robert, I need, of course, non-perturbative observables. I know I can define observables in semi-classically, inter-sitter and perturbatively, but they do not typically generalize, even if I start coupling matter to here in an immediate way to well-defined quantities in this very non-perturbative regime. I mean, one has work to do, right? Mm-hmm. One really must realize we are very, very far from semi classicality. So even if I have now proven that for a notion of curvature I've introduced, I can generate a match, or I said it's compatible with the behavior I would find on a classical manifold. But nevertheless, you must remember, anyway, it's in the sense of expectation values. So things can average out. Yeah. And if I look at other properties of this quantum geometry, I can still see that it's, of course, very, very violently quantum fluctuating. And that interferes with my, you know, let's say, put coordinates on it and treat it as I would a De Sitter space semi-classically.
Next would be a question from Lee.
Yes, hi, Renata. Can you hear me?
Yes, Lee. Hi.
Hi. That's all wonderful work. Can you compute now any correlation functions, say the product of the Ricci curvature at two different points, integrated over the space time?
I think it's technically out of reach.
It's a very
good question because we would like to compute 2-point functions, but the question has always been of what precisely. So I should say, in terms of the sizes of the simulation and the curves I showed you, it's just barely on the edge of being able to make a statement. I mean, the statement I made and the graphs I showed.
Mm-hmm.
We have to be even more clever before we start computing 2-point functions, I fear. Yeah.
Well, good luck. It's great.
So we're running a little bit behind time and I don't see any further urgent questions. So Bianca has already posted the link for Renate's Slack channel, and also Renate agreed to be available in the Remo room in right now in the break if there are further questions or you would like to chat to her informally. So I've just posted the link to the Remo room, which you're all very welcome to join during the break. And let's thank both speakers of the session again.